One. Welcome to MLB from CDA Baseball. I'm your host, James Morris, and today we have a very special guest. I'm super excited to announce my Uncle Norm Clark here on MLB from CDA Baseball. My Uncle Norm covered the Cincinnati Reds as a journalist from 1972 to 1978. As many of you know, this is during the Big Red Machine days, where they won back-to-back world champions in 75 and 76. This said to be a fun time to be a Reds fan. Well, Uncle Norm, I thank you for being here, and I really appreciate it. So let's get right to the questions. How did you end up in Cincinnati as a journalist?
Well, first, thank you very much, James. And what I'll do is I'll start with how unlikely it was that I got into journalism.
Yeah.
My father died when I was 10. My right eye was removed when I was 11. I was a terrible student. I had no interest in anything but sports. My mother thought it was too risky for me to play football, and so I sat out the first 2 years. I was a water boy. I was wherever they needed me, I did it, but my heart was on the field. She relented at the start of my junior year. She needed permission from my eye doctor and my coach and all, but we ended up having a powerhouse team, and I got to start every game, and it totally changed my life. When my football career ended, I hung around, my hometown, which was like about 600-700 people at the time. Everybody else went to college or to the military, didn't have a steady job. I just bounced around from odd job to odd job. And to be honest, I had no future. When I was 20 years old, I was working at a grocery store in my hometown, and one of my responsibilities was to take the grocery store ad to the weekly Terry Tribune. I delivered the ad to the editor, and because I was such an avid sports fan, I asked him if he was going to the basketball tournament that weekend. Terry had one of his best teams, and the town was totally abuzz. The editor said he wasn't much of a sports fan. Then, out of the blue, he said, "Why don't you cover it for me?" Well, those words changed my life. But I had no background in writing, and I certainly wasn't going to share that with him because I didn't want to miss that opportunity. So I covered Terry's sports scene for the Tribune. 6 months later, I was working for a daily newspaper in Miles City, which was probably 35 miles from Terry. And after a year, I went to Helena, where I got a lot of experience putting out a sports section. And my last job in Montana was as sports editor of the Billings Gazette, the largest paper here in the state at the time. Still is, actually. While at the Gazette, during a one-year span, I got to cover a Denver Broncos game, a Rose Bowl, and I spent a week in New York City at a sports journalism seminar. That was a eventful year. After all that excitement, I craved more adventure, but I was torn. I didn't want to give up a dream job, but I didn't want to look back 20 years later and regret I didn't live my life up to my fullest potential. One night, I prayed for guidance. I asked God to give me a sign. I woke up the next morning hoping I would know what to do, but I didn't get a sign. So I decided to look for it in the Billings Gazette. I read every page, no sign. I turned back to the front page and there it was. I saw the date. It was March 4th, but I read it as March, F-O-R-T-H. I took it as my command, March 4th fearlessly. I quit my job and started planning an extended trip to Europe. I loved history. The Olympics were being held in Munich, Germany that year, and I wanted to attend them. The Olympics had been one of my greatest inspirations as a kid. When I was a newspaper boy, I used to draw the Olympic logo, the five circles, in snow while on my paper route. I hoped the Olympics would be my destiny. So I decided to go anyway, even though I couldn't get the credential. I was 30 years old. My parents and friends thought I was crazy, but I wanted to experience life without a safety net. I would figure out what my next job was after I spent a couple of years in Europe. I'm a couple of months in Europe, most of them on trains, by the way. I wasn't able to get a credential for the Olympics, as I mentioned. I toured art museums and ancient churches. I loved war history, so I went to the most famous battleground in history, the Allied invasion along the Normandy beaches. I ran out of money in Spain and went days without food for the first time in my life. I met amazing people. A young U.S. Marine from Idaho gave me a tour of Copenhagen, Denmark. He was waiting for his girlfriend to get off work. He had just left Vietnam, where he survived two bloody battles. His best friends had been killed. He had a fighting knife on his belt. It had saved his life. He wore it, he said, for protection. When I left Europe, I still had no job lined up. I had enough money to go from New York to Montana with probably one meal. As I was going through Ohio, I realized a journalism friend of mine lived in Cincinnati and ran the Associated Press office there. I wasn't quite ready to have my great adventure end, so I hitchhiked to Cincinnati in a snowstorm. It took 4 hours. I watched Bill do his job over those 3 days. He covered the Bengals and the Reds and whatever big stories that had happened in Cincinnati. 3 days later, I went back to Montana in time for Christmas. I went to Helena and got a job with the newspaper there. A month later, I got a call from the AP in Seattle. They offered me a job in Pullman, Washington. I accepted. A day later, I got a call from the AP in Ohio. They offered me a job covering the Cincinnati Reds. I've mentioned I had already accepted a job in Pullman, and I told the Ohio bureau chief that I had committed to a job in Pullman. He said, don't worry about it. I've already talked to Seattle, and they're fine with you taking the job in Cincinnati. That unplanned side trip to Cincinnati changed my life. Wow. So, off I went to Cincinnati, confident I could handle sports duties, but I was a bit nervous that I hadn't covered major news stories. And I'll end it there and let you go to your next question.
Well, that's interesting because, well, you, I mean, all that hard work you had really paid off, I guess, in the end, didn't it?
Yes, it really did. You know, just to get a break in a smaller Montana market, I was able to do, I had to take photos. I had to write headlines. I had to put out the sports section. I had to do interviews. It really prepared me for the AP.
Yeah. While in Cincinnati, did you have a favorite memory in Cincinnati or just a really good time you really could reflect on?
Oh, I can tell you that covering the Reds' great teams of 75 and 76 team with all those all-stars, Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Joe Morgan, George Foster, Tony Perez. That was totally surreal. And then watching Pete Rose surpass Ty Cobb's hit record was a big moment. But probably the biggest moment was, from a historical standpoint, was I was the lead writer the day that Hank Aaron hit his 714th homer that tied Babe Ruth's record. But we'll go into those particulars in a while.
Yeah, well, I think that was amazing. I think that's amazing. But have you ever met Marty Brenneman? What was he like if you did?
I met Marty long before he was before he got to Cincinnati. I had met him in the early 70s in North Carolina at the Sports Writers and Sportscasters convention. Well, it wasn't really a convention. They invited each state's winner in broadcasting and sportscasting, and I got to go but I met Marty by happenstance, and the next thing I know, I'm in Cincinnati, and Al Michaels leaves the job with the Reds to go back to his hometown of San Francisco, and they call up Marty Brenneman. And he was really popular, still is, hugely popular with the Reds. Kara and I were driving back from Cincinnati, and we'd crossed the river, and the Reds game was on, and Marty said, "We'd just like to say hello to an old friend." He had seen my name in the Cincinnati Inquirer that morning, and people like that you know take an extra effort to make you feel great. That's why they go so far.
Mm-hmm. Marty Brenneman, for all those who don't know, he was a Cincinnati Reds announcer, game by game for what, 40, 50 years?
Yeah, he did play by play from 74 until about 3 years ago, I believe.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think he believes in the MLB Hall of Fame, Reds Hall of Fame, for doing all that for those years. So you probably knew him well. I bet that was very exciting. But do you remember your first game covering the Reds, and what was that like? I bet it had to be very exciting.
Well, my very first Reds game was the 1973 opener. I recall Juan Marichal pitched for the Giants and retired 14 in a row in a 4-1 complete game win. He was opposing a 20-year-old Don Gullett, who we all thought was going to be a Hall of Famer the way that he had pitched his first 2 years. He came up as a 19-year-old. But Pete Rose had two hits in that game, which put him very close to the halfway mark to Ty Cobb's record. That's one of the things I remember.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Do you think Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame?
I have said for years that I thought the only way he's going to go in is posthumously. He lied about betting, and he misled baseball in investigation as much as he could, and then when he finally decided to come clean, he put it in a book. And so would I like to see him in the Hall of Fame? Yes, I would. There aren't many ball players I admire than Pete Rose. I mean, those head first slides were all about getting his team all fired up, and he was fearless. I was going to call him the Red Spark Plug, but when you got Joe Morgan there, who can do everything, and Johnny Bench, and they had four or five spark plugs. That was really an incredible team.
Yeah, some people even think 1976 Reds were the greatest of all time, including Pete Rose with that team. Do you think the 1976 Reds were the greatest team, and if so, why?
Well, I went through some of the history, and the 1975 Reds won 108 games, and the only team that's won more games than that in a regular season was the 1906 Chicago Cubs. So they win that. The Reds go on to play the Boston Red Sox in the 75 World Series, and it was a tremendous World Series. I remember watching Carlton Fisk's home run where he waved the ball at the ball to try to stay fair. It's an iconic image played almost every year at the World Series time. But tell me again what the question was, and I'll see if I finished my question and my thoughts on that.
Are the 1976 Reds greatest team of all time, in your opinion?
The 75 team. I'll take the 75 team. I think the Reds, the 76 team, they swept the Yankees, and that was a real feather in their cap. But I think the numbers support the 75 team as maybe being the greatest team of all time.
Interesting. Well, why do you think of that?
Well, the 108 wins that has not not been done by any national team, National League team since then. They had what it was called the Great Eight, and those starters, those red starters, started 88 games and lost only 19. So that was, gave you some idea of how potent that lineup was. And then they had the depth behind them to rest those guys, because you can't play those eight guys all year long, or they'd be gassed by the time the postseason started.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is kind of a tough question to ask. It's kind of controversial, but it's purely your opinion. It could be from any year, any time. But who do you think was the best player on the Reds?
Well, I think you could make a very strong case that Joe Morgan, he had pop in his bat. He could get 20 homers. He could hit for average. He could steal 30, 40 bases a year. And he was combative. He was second to none as far as, you know, getting in the face of somebody that, you know, a youngster that kind of came up and maybe just thought he was going to get by on his looks and batting average. But no, he was really probably the most complete player I ever saw.
That's nice. Yeah. And Joe Morgan had some really good years with the Reds too.
Yes, sure did.
Yeah. How about Johnny Bench? What are your thoughts on Johnny Bench? Do you think some people say he's the greatest catcher of all time? What are your thoughts on Johnny Bench?
I would agree that he's the greatest catcher. When I got there, he had just hit 40 home runs. That day I got off the train in Lima, Ohio, and then hitchhiked to Cincinnati. My friend in Cincinnati couldn't pick me up. He was going to pick me up in Lima, a 2-hour drive away. But when I called back, he said, "Hey, I can't do it. Johnny Bench is in the hospital. They've found cancer I think it was his throwing arm, right arm, I believe." So when I got there, Cincinnati was absolutely just holding its breath that the diagnosis would, or that they removed the suspected cancer, and it turned out that it wasn't. But boy, it put a scare in everybody. But he never hit. He never matched. He never came close to 40 home runs again. But he didn't have to. He still had the power to get the doubles and all. But he, I'll always wonder just what he was capable of doing, what he could have done if he had not had the shoulder surgery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now. This can take as long as you want about this question. I mean, this is purely whatever you want on this. But what was the most fun you had covering a Reds game or any game? But I know there's a lot of those games out there, winning the World Series those 2 years. But it could be a regular season game. It could be a spring training game. But whatever you need, for how long you need. What was the most fun you had covering a Reds game?
Well, nothing would top going to those World Series. But since you want to narrow it down to a Reds game, 4th of July weekend in 1973, I ordered tickets for a doubleheader against the Dodgers on my day off. So when my date and I got to the stadium, they didn't have my tickets. A PR guy rushed down to save the day. He walked us down to our seats, and what was odd is that he kept walking and walking down toward the field. We ended up in the second row in the team owner's seats. That was a first. The Reds won that game. I mean, it was one of the most dramatic Reds games in the 6 years that I was there. The Reds won the game on a two-out, two-run homer by pinch hitter Hal King in the ninth, beat the Dodgers. Cincinnati won the next game then to get the doubleheader sweep. In fact, I think they won all three games. But they opened I think the Dodgers came in seven games behind, and the Reds, and they left the 10 games behind. And that pretty much, that was pretty much it. That was the Reds' big push. They had opened up a good lead, and they had, you know, one of the things that always surprised me when I go back and look at it is the Reds' pitching was a lot better than most of us think. I mean, they in 75, I think the team ERA was something like 3.50, and I think a year later it was like 3.58. They were very consistent. They had good relievers, and it was a complete team.
Yeah. So what was it like covering the Reds in your time? I mean,
oh, you know what? I didn't. You know what, James? I just realized I didn't. I didn't. That was the game. I mean, I think I set a record for eating hot dogs that day. I'm here. I am. I don't have to work. I'm just having a great time, and I got to see baseball at its finest. The drama was there and all that. I'll always remember that as one of my best days at Riverfront.
That's very cool. And how was the Riverfront Stadium? How was that a lot better than the newer one at the Reds, the Great American Ballpark? Or what are your thoughts on those two different stadiums?
Well, it was the stadium was that was the era of multi-use stadiums. So you might recall that Pittsburgh and Cincinnati had basically cookie cutter stadiums. It looked like the same architect drew them both up. But there's a real problem with sharing major league teams sharing a stadium. The configuration is such that you could have the out of bounds, you know, a few feet away from something might come out with an angle or a corner or something could be very dangerous for an outfielder trying to run down a ball. But no, that I had great fond memories at Riverfront. You know, one of the things the Reds did that was pretty revolutionary and risky is that they went with to AstroTurf. And I think Houston probably had it first, but the Reds, with all the, you know, the spring storms that came in and all, they had a lot of games washed out just because they puddles of water on it. So once they went to AstroTurf, they got a lot of their games in, and sometimes they ended at midnight or past midnight. But that was really a difference maker. That team just got on a roll and stayed on a roll.
And most importantly, how was the food in Riverfront, right?
Hey, I'll tell you what, I still crave Cincinnati chili. The food at the Riverfront, they had Red Hots, which were the spicy hot dogs. They had the white hot dogs, I think it's the white bratwurst. Somebody's going to call and tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. But they had bratwurst, and they had also a white hot dog that was terrific as well. And they had some fantastic mustards. And I'm wishing that I could dive into a platter of that.
I bet, yeah. I bet I already know the question to this. It had been super fun being a journalist for all those years, but how was it like covering the Reds in the 70s? I know you covered many teams over your years, but how was it like covering the Reds through your time in the 70s?
Well, before I got there, 1970, I was still at the Billings Gazette. They lost to the Baltimore Orioles. in 72. They lost to Oakland. The Reds were right on the cusp when I got there. And to be able to see that team come together, James, they were like, I don't know if you were, if you have heard that, but Dallas, the Dallas Cowboys for years were known as America's team. Mm-hmm. And because they got great ratings and they were on all the time. Well, the Reds were on as well. The Reds, everybody, I mean, a lot of people loved the Reds because they had such a colorful group, a colorful, talented, powerful group of players. And they meant business in 1975 and 76. And that was something that I was honored to be a part of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Over that span of time, did you ever have a favorite Reds player that you liked to interview? And how about even a least favorite?
Well, nobody was a better quote than Pete Rose. I mean, he was funny. He was analytical. He was a student of baseball history. He always had a crowd of sports writers around him. I had good times and bad times with him, but I just admired the heck out of him for the things that he did on a baseball field.
Mm-hmm.
Least favorite might surprise you. Tom Seaver was difficult. And shortly after I wrote about his slow start with the Reds, he drove a motorcycle. It was pregame, and we heard this small motorcycle that I think that the grounds crew would use to run out and to take care of something at second base during the inning break, and we heard this motorbike revving up in the walkway down to the field, but it was coming up into the clubhouse, and all of a sudden there's Seaver, 6'3", 220-pound Seaver on this little bike, and he's revving the gas, and everybody's laughing, getting a kick out of it. When I forgot something pretty important, he was in long johns. That's all. He was just wearing long johns. And all of a sudden, he took off, gunned it, and took off, headed right straight for this group of sports writers. And I was on the very right-hand side, and he looked like he was going straight to get as many as he could, but he peeled off at the last second, ran into me, rammed me to the ground. I looked up, I'm flat on my back, the motorcycle's front wheels are on my chest, and he's gunning the engine. And I was not happy about that. To this day, I have a small bone broken in my right foot that I never went in to get fixed. And so your Uncle Norm walks like a penguin. It's not a pretty sight.
Well, good memories, I guess, so you have to say, at least. But that's funny.
I never wrote about that. By the way, I never wrote about that because wow. I thought I didn't want to be one of those people that, covered a team and then got injured and then filed a big lawsuit against the team or something. I did not want to be that person. So I never wrote about it. Wow. So people have to look up with me looking like a penguin.
Well, some people are going to know now, maybe.
Yeah. I'll give you another one. George Foster could be very uncooperative. If he was dealing with a slump, he froze out the media. I remember asking him if I could have 5-10 minutes with him, and he said, "Nope, I don't talk to negative reporters." And I was like astounded. I said, "I'm a negative reporter." I said, "George, last year when you got 52 home runs, we were talking every day. I was doing a feature a day on you. I never heard anything about being a negative reporter." But the difference was that the Reds were having a tough year, and And he was feeling the pressure of that, you know, that more was being expected of him. And that's how, at that level, somebody in the front office probably told him that you're not living up to your potential, or worse. Mm-hmm. And so he kind of took it out on us a bit. But I ran into him in the Mets stadium about 10 years later. I was working in Denver at the time, and I got on an elevator, and there were several people on it, and all of a sudden I heard this voice, Norm Clark. And I looked, and there was George Foster, and we had a little chat, nice little chat. You know, one of the things that I've always said about Pete Rose is that he might get in your face over something, but the next day he'd come up to you, shake your hands, and said, "That's behind us." And I always thought that was really classy. And I learned a lot about being a better person as a result of covering people that were tremendous characters. And I don't mean characters in the way of, well, he's a character. I mean, their character was mm-hmm. really something.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's very cool and interesting. As a journalist, how many different MLB teams did you get passed on to? So you were on the Reds a couple times. You were with Denver. Are those just the two teams, or how many teams did you go along?
Well, I covered the Reds for 6 seasons. Then I went to San Diego and covered the Padres for, let's see, from 79 to 83. I left to become the AP's coordinator of coverage for the Associated Press during the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. So I got to see a lot of baseball and enjoyed it. I saw Tom Seaver's no-hitter, but that was a night off. And it turned out that I ended up working till 2 a.m, even though I was off that night. I wanted to, it was such a big thing that there was no way I was going to go home without, you know, pitching in and helping, but that was pretty cool. I forgot where I was going. Tell me if I answered that question for you.
You did. Enough. The question was, how many MLB teams did you go on?
Yeah. So I guess I covered the Reds. Then I covered San Diego. Then I went to the Olympics. Then the Rocky Mountain News in Denver offered me the job of being the lead, not the lead writer of, but the... I wrote about the baseball coming to Denver. I was in charge of that assignment. And that was, I think it took about 6 or 7 years. But boy, when they got there, the Reds, I think, opened at home against the Chicago Cubs. And it was a madhouse. They played in Mile High Stadium, which could hold, I think it was 90-some thousand. They set records that hadn't been broken. The Dodgers, when they moved out to the West Coast, played in the L.A. Coliseum, and they had crowds. They had big crowds, but they couldn't maximize all that space because they had to put up. It was cramped down one, I think it was down the first baseline. And it was really an asymmetrical ballpark with a lot of quirks to it. But the Rockies, boy, you look it up, and they averaged record numbers. That was really a cool time to live in Denver.
Yeah, wow. That. How many people roughly do you think were there?
Well, I think I think that the first couple games they got 90,000.
Oh wow!
If They destroyed they destroyed the attendance records that year. It was goosebump time all the time. They the ball flew a lot farther, and no lead was safe. It was like a softball game, 23-21 scores, and and then you moved to the new stadium in 95. So they were there from 93, 94, and then they moved into their new stadium, which is one of the most beautiful in all of baseball. Wow. I think I saw you there in May a year ago, right?
Yeah, I was there, yeah.
What'd you think of the ballpark?
Well, I really liked it. I like those trees in center field too. It kind of has that good feeling to the ballpark. That's probably my favorite one I've gone to. I've only been to like three though, but yeah, I like it a lot.
Not many have the mountains for the backdrop. That's one of the things I really love.
That's what I was talking about. Yeah.
Sure.
As a journalist, you've probably got a lot of advice over the past lot of years you've done it. What advice would you give people that would want to become a journalist when they get older?
Well, I would tell them to be their self. Be true to yourself. If you are covering a team and you get information huge for a huge story, you have to make a decision. Do you write the story and be a journalist, or do you worry about the Reds being upset at you, not talking to you about management, threatening to take away your credentials, that sort of thing? Journalism is a tremendous profession, and I loved almost every minute of it. There were a couple of times when Pete Rose slapped me, but that was back in when he got to Las Vegas and I wrote that he was one of the worst tippers in town. And so he never forgave me for that one. But that's not true. Again, the next time we were in that restaurant, my wife said, Norm, Pete Rose just walked in and he's walking toward us. And I said, oh yeah, sure he is. And she goes, he is. I said, yeah. Next thing I know, he's got me in a headlock and he goes, you blankety blank, you write something bad about me and I'll have to rip your head off or something. And I said, I heard you were coming in. I've been expecting the Pete Rose, full blown treatment. So no, he's a good guy, and I know that it just so happened that I, as an out of towner, I mean, I came in and I didn't know anyone in Cincinnati, but I noticed one day that a high school football player for a big school in Cincinnati was going to go to the University of Montana. So I recognized the name. I think they had the name of his father in the thing, and I knew that the father wrote sports. He was probably in his 60s then, wrote sports for a suburban team. And I mean, for a suburban newspaper, small paper. And I sent him a note and said, hey, I came from Denver. I'm sorry, I came from Montana. I covered many Montana State, Montana games. And congratulations to your son. I'm a native Montana. If there's anything I can ever do to help him or help you, let me know. Well, he sent me a note back and said, can I buy you at lunch and introduce you to my son? And I said, sure. So I end up hiring, his name was Big Bill, and he was 400 pounds. And he had known Pete Rose since Pete was about 12 or 13. And Pete would tell him stories that one time it was one of the biggest, actually it turned into one of the biggest stories I covered was that Pete was very upset at the Reds because they were trying to lowball him on his salary. And he told Big Bill, I told my attorney to tell the Reds that if they think I'm too rich for their blood, they can trade me to Philadelphia. Well, you can imagine, I went to Pete. Of course, I had to go to Pete, and he didn't want to talk about it. He said, I'll give you the story in November. And I said, Pete, if I wait until November and it ends up in the Cincinnati Enquirer and the Cincinnati Post before I write it, and my bosses hear that, they're going to say, you're a little too cozy with the players. Who are you working for, the Cincinnati Reds or the Associated Press? That's what I would have heard. Mm-hmm. And if I had sat on that story. And so I didn't promise him I was going to write it. I didn't promise him I wouldn't write it. I just said, that's not my decision. I have to report back to the AP and tell them what your response was. And he said, well, that story better not end up in print. And well, the AP said, that's a huge story. Pete's salary discussions are not going well. We're not going to sit on that story. So I wrote it, and he was furious with me. At one point, he told a TV station that guy knows it's wrong, and it's fabricated. It's pure hogwash, and it wasn't. He ended up with Philadelphia Phillies, just as I had written about. And he wouldn't talk to me at spring training for probably 3 or 4 days. And I decided to just to approach it head on. I went up to him and I said, Pete, if a story I wrote was wrong in any way and damaged your salary discussions, I will apologize to you right here. And I said it loud enough that several players heard it. And Pete looked me in the eye and said, you don't have to apologize. Your story was right. And boy, that was a moment, because he had froze me out of a lot of different conversations during spring training. You know, the players, after a game is over, the players will start walking toward the dugout, and the writers will follow the star of the game or whatever. And he would not talk to me. And so I thought, well, this is going to be a long year. But I give him credit. I mean, he I think he was surprised that I took the approach that I did. And I was more than pleased that he was honest about it, and we got along fine until the next controversy. I don't remember what it was, but you know, it's a love hate affair. I'm not the first sports writer that'll tell you that you better not ever try to get too close to a ball player, because it's going to be very uncomfortable at times when you've got to write a story that they don't want to see in the paper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for this next question, I bet there's plenty of reasons why, but I just want to hear your main reason. Why did you leave Cincinnati, and why did you head to San Diego after Cincinnati?
I had spent 6 years in Cincinnati. I had covered some of the biggest news stories. I was the first reporter at the scene of a fire that killed 165 people and injured 400 or 500 others. And I went from the guy that was spent 3 days driving to Cincinnati 6 years earlier, saying to myself, I know I can write sports, but how will I react when there is a major story? And I worried about that so much that when it happened, I just went through a list in my head. Okay, there's a bad fire. I'm going to call the Associated Press office in Columbus. That was the hub bureau, and tell them that I'm heading for the fire. And I'll call them as soon as I get there. I said, except I don't have a, no, nobody had a phone back then. That was the crazy thing. Now it had been, I mean, being the first reporter at the scene, I would have had pictures that no one else had, that sort of thing. But then, you know, that was, the iPhone was still many, many, several decades away. But I was very pleased that I rose to the occasion to write when I was offered, at the end of the 6 year, I was offered a job in Miami, and I went down and listened to them, and it was it sounded exciting because adventure was always been a part of my life ever since I, you know, took off to Europe for 2.5 months. But I came back, and I owed so much to the sports editor of the AP that I could not accept any job without talking to him first. And he said, well, promise me that you will not accept that job. Give me 24 hours. So he called me the next day and said, name your bureau. I said, what do you mean? He said, where do you want to go? You can have any bureau you want to go to in the country, AP bureau you want to go to. I said, Chicago. And he said, well, why Chicago? And I said, because you got all sorts of pro teams there. And I mean, every league has a team in Chicago. And he called back and he said, well, you're not going to believe this, but we just hired a guy from Montana. And so we can't turn around and tell him that we're taking the job away from him. What's your second choice? I said, San Diego. And he said, why San Diego? And I said, because it's the worst AP bureau in the country. I said, the sports is an afterthought there. You don't have anyone dedicated to sports there. I would change that. I would change that immediately. He goes, you got the job. You got San Diego. So that's how I ended up in San Diego. And then as a result of going to San Diego is when I was offered the job in Los Angeles, the Olympic job. Then that turned out well. And then after the Olympics, I went to Denver to cover Major League's arrival in Denver. And I was able to break the story that Denver was getting a National League franchise. And broke the story in 91. And they got there 2 years later. So I've had a blessed life. I'm writing a book about all the incredibly influential and inspirational people that I've met in my life. And I hope to have that done in the next 3 or 4 months.
Well, that's awesome. Two more questions and then we can get out of your hair. I don't know. But
anytime. Take as much time as you want.
Awesome. Yeah, same here for you. Have you ever got interviewed by Marty Brenneman, you're the play-by-play announcer, on the radio before?
Have I been? No, I don't think. I don't think Marty ever. I don't think any reason. I can remember that when I wrote the story that Pete was so angry about. That he told his attorney to tell the Reds to trade him to Philadelphia. I can remember thinking, I wonder what Marty's going to say, because if Marty said that story was a fabrication, that meant he believed Pete. If he supported me, then maybe Pete and the players would not support Marty. Well, he very carefully, very diplomatically reported what I had written in the paper. He didn't say, that it was a story that, premature, or any of those kinds of words. He just took a very fair look at it and said, there, you know, there's probably more to this story than meets the eye. And so I had great respect for him. He was really good.
Mm-hmm. And the last question, arguably maybe the most important one and interesting, is can you tell us about how it was covering Hank Aaron's 714th home run? Tell us in every detail possible on what you saw there and how amazing that was.
Oh, well, that's quite a story, as you will see when we get to the end of it. So it's the 1974 season opener. I've been there 1 year. The first year, they had the sports editor of the Columbus Bureau come down and handle it because they didn't know about this new kid, whether it was going to be too big a stage for me, or whether I was going to choke on it or whatever. And the second year, Aaron comes to town needing one home run to tie Babe Ruth. I'm sorry, to tie. Yes, to tie Babe Ruth. And the Reds or the AP said, you're going to be the lead writer on this. And, we want you to be prepared. And so the day before, the both teams were working out at Riverfront Stadium when there were reports, sirens going off of tornadoes. And about 3 miles away, down the Ohio River, a swarm of tornadoes, called an outbreak, they hopscotched across the Ohio River, went up through Cincinnati suburbs, touching down and knocking down, that might have been 30, 40 homes. Nobody was killed. But when it built up to an F5, and it wiped out the city of Xenia, Ohio.
Wow.
I think it was 35 dead, something like 10,000 homes destroyed. But that, I've always thought, what would have happened if that tornado had gathered right across the river from Riverfront Stadium and gone through and ripped up the city? They would have canceled that series because it would have, the devastation and death toll would have been such that they wouldn't think twice about playing a baseball game with a city in mourning like that.
Yeah.
So I've always thought about that, but I was out covering, getting my quotes for the next day for the, just writing the story about this historical day that's coming up. And a guy approached me from an AP legend, a sports writer from Atlanta, said, Norm, there's an AP rule that when an AP sports writer comes to town, the home AP writer's got to buy him a beer. I said, "Well, okay, I'll be happy to do that. Let's have dinner tonight." And so we had dinner, and the next morning I got up and I had the worst hay fever I've had. I didn't even know I was allergic to the hay fever. Well, I looked through my medicine cabinet and I found a pill for hay fever. I took it, and an hour later, I'm at the ball game, and my stomach started acting up, started swirling, and I thought, oh no, I cannot get sick, I cannot get knocked out of action with Hank Aaron one swing away from history.
Yeah.
And I sat in the front row of the press box, and it was getting worse. And suddenly, Hank Aaron walks to the on deck circle, and I couldn't stand it anymore. I ran to the restroom. I got sick, and I came back, and the sweat's running off my forehead. As I sit in my chair, he goes to bat, and he takes the first three pitches, all balls, and then with his first swing of the spring, he hits number 714. And I, to this day, I'm thankful that I got there when I did, because if I'd have missed that, Uncle would have been a punchline. I would have been a lot of hall of shames for that day, because it just would have not been good. Yeah. But so what happened then, let's see. I think Rose got three hits in that game, but, so the next day the Braves had a justifiable beef. They wanted to hold him out until they wanted the record set in Atlanta, and they were going to be going back from Cincinnati to Atlanta on their next thing. Well, the manager and the general manager of the Braves, they had a press conference and said they were going to hold Hank out of the opener. So the commissioner of baseball, Bowie Kuhn, ruled that that would not be the fair way to handle things, is orchestrate when a player should be playing, when he's going after a record. So he ruled that he had to play in at least one game. So that's how Hank Aaron got his tying home run in the season opener. And yeah, everybody was happy. Wow. I certainly was.
Wow, that's truly remarkable. That's amazing. Well, I really appreciate you having me here with Uncle Norm. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, of course. I'm glad that I got to share the stories with you, James. It's been the various times we've been together, it was never conducive to sitting around and just talking baseball. And I know what a great fan you are. And this I'm so pleased about your podcasting. I think you do a tremendous job, and I want you to stay at it, because you just never know where your life is going to lead you.
Well, thank you. I will do that. And I really appreciate you having me on. There's actually one more question. It's not a huge question, but what are your thoughts on the present day Reds? And what do you think they could be good this year? I don't know, but what are your thoughts on the present day Reds?
Well, I was surprised, because that team I saw, you know, you and your family flew down to Denver last mid-May, and I thought, I mean, they were the Rockies kept taking the lead, and the Reds just kept coming back. I thought I saw a lot. I thought I saw a team with a lot of resilience, and so. I think they had they had been in the race the year before, maybe the year before that, right down to the end almost, and then their pitching kind of let them down. Mm-hmm. But I thought that they had a good nucleus. I was surprised that, but I kept seeing those trades come in about who was leaving. I thought that guy, you couldn't get him out in Denver. And, I mean, it was Winker, and I can't remember who the other guy was that I had. He had big days there. But, no, I was surprised. It told me that they were throwing in the towel. They were rebuilding the team. And you don't normally see a team that's reconstructed like that. You don't see them really take off the next year. It's like a certain gelling has to happen, bonding of players and that sort of thing. And then they have to lose a really tough playoff. Or, I mean, I almost always bet on a team that's been there before against the team that's for the first time, because there's butterflies and there's the big stage and all of that. But Yeah, that was a surprise to see that. But I think they've got a tremendous core. They've got four or five guys that are there, and they. I don't know much about the new guys, but I think they're going to be a team in contention before long.
Interesting. Yeah. And that's it. I appreciate you on this. I really, really do. All those people who are listening to this podcast, please share it. And all those listening, take some other listens. And I really, really appreciate you having me on, or having you on, Uncle Norm.
That's quite all right, James. I'm just delighted to know that you've become such a great sports fan. Sports fans run in our family, as you know. So it's great to see you carrying the torch.
Well, thank you. That was a podcast, Uncle Norm from MLB from CDA Baseball. Please take another listen and see you next time.